Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome to another Britflix.com podcast. My name is Stuart Wright, and today's guest is producer Charlotte Atkinson. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I'm so excited that I get to do this with you because it's been coming for a little while, I think.
It has. But you'd be glad to know that 2 years is the longest.
Oh, I'm not even close to the record then. That's fine.
Right then. You are from Our Daughter Productions. Now, do you want to talk, that's your company. So do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself before we get into the main topic, which is what producers want?
Yeah, absolutely. I love the fact that it's Our Daughter, and people will say to me, do you have a daughter? And I say no. It just came to me as a name. I started producing when I was 19, which is probably way too young to start producing. But I was on the BFI Academy, and we had a brilliant exec producer come and explain what producing actually was, because I think until someone explains what a producer does and what the role is, it's very difficult to get your head around it. Mm. It's very difficult to get your head around which type of producer you're aiming for or what they all do. And so we had a great producer come in, explained it, and it was like a light bulb moment where I went, oh, that's what I want to do. Cool, I'll just do that then. So me and my 19-year-old confidence set off and got on with it and produced two short films by the time I'd finished the academy. And once you have two credits as anything, you can just get on with it. I think two credits is the point where people stop kind of questioning you a little bit, or they lose that skepticism over whether you can do the job. So I started producing, I carried on, I set up Our Daughter Productions, and that's basically how I'm here.
What was the advice that was given to you, or what was the explanation given to you that the penny dropped about what a producer is or what a producer can be?
Yeah, I think it was the explanation of how it includes everything, of how you get to be the first one in and the last one out, and you get to be involved creatively as much as you want to, as is good for the project, but you also get to do the business, the sales, the marketing, the kind of team leadership management style things. And growing up, I was very focused, weirdly focused, on what career I was going to do.
Yeah.
Because I had very brilliant work-focused parents. And I used to be terrified that I would get stuck in a job that would be just one thing rather than all of the things that I love to do. So as soon as I found out producing included everything, and you got to be involved from day one, really not just support someone else's vision, but be an integral part of creating it and bringing it to life, that was the thing that I really wanted to do.
Yeah, because I guess you can be, if you think of like a film, you're the project manager. If you think about productions across the piece, you're then the CEO. And then when things start moving, you can be the head of operations. You can be managing people directly, and depending on the scale of the production, or depending on how many heads you need when the production starts.
I mean, that's the thing. I train in stage management, and so the film equivalent is first AD.
Yeah.
And as much as I enjoy the paperwork side of things, which everyone thinks is very strange, apart from me, I love the paperwork. But I didn't love the fact that you couldn't be involved creatively as a first AD. You would only ever be able to take whichever projects were being made at the time. And I loved the idea of being able to create and shape stories and bring them to life rather than just manage the production itself.
Okay, then. So then thinking about you setting up your company, what are the type of films that you are aspiring to produce then? If being, obviously, by being the company, you get to be right there at the beginning when someone might email you or you meet at an event who says, I've got an idea for a film. What about this? So what are you in the market for?
Short films, specifically female filmmakers or newer filmmakers with an interesting perspective or a way of telling a story that we feel like we know, but we haven't actually seen to that depth or that level before. You know, any kind of story about a dreamer daring to do something differently will usually grab my attention.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a firm believer in that we all have one type of story that we're always drawn to. And if you dig down deep enough, you'll find the core of the story is the same across everything, regardless of genre, regardless of style, character, any of those things. For me, anything that I love, it's a dreamer who's going to go out and be a little bit different in how they want to achieve something. There are a bunch of examples I could give you. I think the easiest one is Elle Woods in Legally Blonde. You know, the way that she succeeds by creating connection with fairly unlikely friends is a pretty straightforward example, I think.
And do you want to tell us about a production you've got on the go or one that's out there being seen?
Oh, sure. I mean, well, we've just released on YouTube, I say just, I think it was about 2 months ago now. And that is quite a Marmite film. It's hilarious to watch people's reactions to it, honestly. It is a silent 9-minute film about coercive control in an older couple. And so we get everything in the comments. It did fairly well on the festival circuit, which I really appreciated because if you don't have any experience of coercive control, the whole film will go over your head. Whereas other people watch it, you see it in their eyes. They go, oh, I've been in this situation. I know what that character is feeling. I know why she's flinching as soon as the front door opens.
Okay. So yeah. And therefore there being no need for dialogue then, because it's all about.
Yeah, that was the thing. It started off with a bit of dialogue. Before the script came to me, there was a version with some dialogue. And by the time it got to me, there was no dialogue. And funnily enough, it didn't need any. And so you get to see how the husband controls every action of the wife through tiny little movements or a hand signal or even sometimes just like an eyebrow movement. But we get everything in the comments from this is a perfect short film, which is a direct quote, which I very much enjoyed, all the way through to this is a hate crime against men.
Really?
Which I thought was, a bit extreme, considering we don't kill anyone in the film, we don't attack anyone in the film. Yeah, it's interesting to see.
Yeah, that sounds like he doth protest too much.
Yeah, it's quite funny seeing people that fully don't get it. So that one, again, we put on YouTube a couple of months ago. The next one that will be in production, depending on schedules, is called To the Moon and Back. And it is about a space-obsessed autistic boy dealing with the death of one of his dads. And you see how his older sibling has to deal with the grief and resentment over the fact that her younger brother took up so much of their dad's time. And see the kind of impact that a learning disabled sibling has on a family in a way that isn't cruel in any sense of that word at all, but just in a way that's truthful and realistic whilst dealing with something incredibly difficult, like losing a parent.
Wow. Now you said that.
Really happy films, I would say.
Well, you know, if you're tapping into human emotion and trying to uncover them universal truths, then in the end, ordinary life is dramatic, isn't it, in a way, and that film can show that off.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. It's finding those stories that people maybe wouldn't see ordinarily or wouldn't experience personally, and just finding a way to show it in a way that isn't glamorized or made extra gritty just for the sake of you know, it's a film and you can be gratuitous with some things. So in a nutshell, that's kind of what we focus on.
Brilliant, brilliant. And you said at the outset it's short films that you're only doing. You've not got your eye on feature films. Is that because of not yet or is that not ever?
I mean, I was in the middle of working on a feature, multiple features actually, in 2020. So you can guess how that went. Excuse me. I was working on features in 2020 and having multiple calls with wonderful people, Lionsgate, sales agents, all sorts of great people. And then the cinemas closed and then everything else closed. And since then, the landscape for features has changed dramatically, not for the better. And you see how the UK industry has always had to compete against the US industry, particularly with things like box office takings.
Yeah.
But it is so much harder. The financing is virtually impossible now. You know, there was a relatively recent article with Alison Owen talking about how it was actually easier to get indie features financed in the 90s before the tax credit came in. Or tax rebate, as I should say. We have a tax rebate in the UK, not a credit. I had a film financing masterclass once and the instructor was like, it's a rebate, guys. Stop calling it a credit. So I always mentally correct myself. So in that sense, as much as I love feature films and they are extremely powerful and moving and brilliant, for me, it doesn't seem to make the most amount of sense. And it's also extremely difficult to get a feature film made without an A-list cast, writer or director. And so the opportunity to support newer filmmakers or just less established filmmakers generally is so much more difficult with features than it is with shorts. And I would rather prioritize helping newer or less established filmmakers make their next short film so they can, you know, get into higher film festivals or get to work with bigger budgets or just get that next step up. That's what I would rather be focusing on at the time being. So maybe features in the future.
Indeed. Well, no, that's honourable work you're doing, giving people the platform and opportunity to hone their skills and make a mark. That's the first step on the ladder, I suppose. Right then. The reason I invited you on the show was to do with a Instagram post you put out saying, what do producers want? And I thought it was fascinating what you were saying. So I said, do you want to come and talk about this on the podcast? And here we are. So if we start at the top of there, of what that thought was that prompts you to do it, and then we'll go into the sort of, you know, what is the process between a writer and a producer in the sense of what does a producer want, if that's the question. And me as a screenwriter, I'm all ears about this. So I welcome all your observations and your advice at this stage, as well as other writers that may be listening. And of course, producers who'd be listening in, you know, sort of, you know, what do you call it? Sharpening their tools, as it were, and being ready to be a producer as well, because there's, I'm guessing, as much as somebody can can expect something different, and maybe a weaker producer could end up being that producer that someone's trying to make them into, when that's not necessarily what a producer has to be doing. So in that sense, what not to do? Let's start there first, right? And I think for you, I think the words you said to me were something like, writers love to retreat into the minutiae of their stories. Do you want to expand on what that is in terms of, and maybe give us an anecdote of a meeting you might have had?
It's extremely overwhelming and nerve-wracking when you go into a meeting, even if it's just on Zoom or even if it's just an email. It's extremely nerve-wracking to say, this is a thing that I have made that has come quite literally from me. I'm handing it over to you. And I have virtually no defenses if you say anything negative in any way about it. And so when you have that whole process going on in this meeting, email, whatever it happens to be, it's very easy to just dive straight into all of the creative work that you've done. Right, you'll start talking about the character's backstory or the setting or maybe some of the visual things. You want to incorporate a lot of blue tones, any of these specific details that will make up the creative infrastructure of the film, all of which is wonderful and very useful and important to the film. But as a producer, it means pretty much nothing to me. purely from a production sense. Mm. Now, bear in mind that every producer will sit somewhere on the creative business spectrum. Some are more creatively driven, others are more business driven. So the more you get to know a producer before you have that meeting, you can kind of tailor what you're saying to whether they lean more business, lean more creative.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go straight in with this whole character backstory and the setting and the scenery and all of these things, it doesn't help me get any clear sense of what's the scale of this film? How long are we going to be shooting for? What does the budget need to be? What are the big requirements for this going to be that are going to cost us more money? And then I can start weighing up, is it worth spending the money on this? Or is there a way to kind of cheat it that saves us some money? All of these things are the kind of producer wheels that start turning.
Mm.
You know, things like, do you want to go to festivals? Will this do really well at festivals? Or will it do better going direct to online? You know, for you as a filmmaker, for your career, is going to festivals going to be the useful next step up? You know, getting to bigger festivals or getting awards in, all of those kinds of things are what producers generally need to hear. But I have been in plenty of meetings, the worst of which I'll tell you about in a minute, but plenty of meetings where people go straight into all of the creative details and tell me nothing that I need to know from a production sense. You know, I used to go for meetings in person with, you know, in a cafe somewhere. I stopped doing that even before COVID, purely because of one meeting where a writer told me everything possible about this film. This was a 12-minute short film. So you wouldn't think there could be, you know, that much to talk about. You would be wrong. He went through the entire backstory of every character. And I kept trying to move the meeting along. I kept saying, like, that sounds great. Where are you up to with casting? Do you have any locations in mind? And he would go, yeah, yeah, I'll get back to that. Anyway, after this character's 12th birthday. And so I just sat back down and was like, you know what? I'm just going to let him get all of this out. I will sip my now cold cappuccino and just wait until he's got all of this out of his system. I put on my best, like I'm still paying attention to every detail of what you're telling me face. Until a woman at the table next to us got up to go to the bathroom, walked past our table, and she'd held up a napkin on which she'd written, do you need help?
No.
So, so I clearly looked like I was trapped on a terrible first date rather than just in a pitch meeting with a guy who will not stop talking about the 12-year-old protagonist's football obsession. It's just... So that's the extreme of like the creative minutiae that you can get into.
Yeah. So in that sense, then, if you were able to sit that person down and tell them how they should have handled that meeting, what would be the first? Because we're going to rewind in a second about looking at how partnerships and the how you make relationships with producers as a writer. But just thinking of that meeting in particular, when you've got to that stage, how should the writer have handled that meeting?
I would say mentally split the meeting up into sections. Go through everything that you know you need to talk to a producer specifically about.
Mm.
So yes, you have the creative stuff, but there's also a bunch of other stuff you have to know as well. Things like, what do you want to do for distribution? Like, do you have strong feelings about whether you want to go to festivals? Do you want to go direct to online? Of course, this varies if it's a TV show, if it's a feature, whatever it happens to be. But again, that's a thing that a producer needs to know. Locations, where do you want to film this? Budget-wise, what do you want to be working with? Is it kind of a shoestring, we get everyone together there on the day? Or is it much more of a well-built-out, structured sort of budget? All of these different details of creative, distribution, finance, practical production things. Any other details, you know, if there's a charity that you want to work with, treating the film more like a business, and looking through all of these different areas of the business rather than just the creative aspects, it means that you can get through the meeting relatively quickly. So you don't get stuck on one particular subject for 45 minutes. I wish I was exaggerating. It means that the producer gets everything they need to know and they get a very clear picture of the project, the business as a whole, rather than having to kind of prod you for questions every 2 or 3 minutes.
If the writer director come to you because they didn't have answers to some of those questions, that's still reasonable, isn't it? That would be if you'd said it was a short story about dementia, and you'd said you've spoken to any charities about whether there's any funding available or something like that, It's not that they have to know that or anything. It's more like, oh, I hadn't thought of that. Do you want to?
Oh, no, not at all. I don't mind if someone says, I have no idea about festivals or I have no idea about funding.
Yeah.
If anything, I appreciate the honesty. But I think having that awareness of what producers need to know about, all those different areas that producers will want to speak to you about, that is going to make it a lot easier because you get to kind of work section by section. And you can say, you know, in terms of distribution, I'm completely open. I don't mind either way. I don't know if this will do well at festivals. So that's something that I'd be looking to really discuss and work with you on, get your feedback and opinion on. See, that is a very, like, it gives me all the information that I need. And there's no having to, like, pretend you know stuff that you don't. There's no use in trying to pretend stuff that you don't. It doesn't help anyone.
No, indeed. Now, let's, now that this is at the kind of point of a relationship where you've sort of, there's been some back and forth and information exchanged, and maybe that's the point when you first meet in person. So let's rewind to the start of that process and see if we can't fix it and not be in the position that you were in that cafe. Point one that you wanted to talk about was it's about focusing on partnership. What do you mean by that?
I think recognizing that a producer is just a regular person in the same way you're a regular person. Plenty of pitch emails start with, hi, I've got a script. I'm looking for a producer. Let me know if you would be interested. And for me, it would be a bit like if I came to you and said, hi, I need a writer. You'll do. Right? It's not going to be the greatest invitation you've ever received, I'm going to guess. And bear in mind, even if it's a short film, you'll work together for 2 years, maybe longer. You know, I'm coming up on 3 years with Wool. I'm still updating the marketing content. Like, I'm still prepping new marketing content. It's 3 years of working with someone. So you have to know from the beginning, do I actually want to work with this person for 3 years? Do we have the same sense of humor? Like, do we have the same aims and ambitions for this film? Otherwise, you're both going to go off in slightly separate directions. It makes for a very difficult creative working relationship. So partnership is really just about getting to know a person before you dive straight into a pitch.
It also makes me think that it's both personal and strategic at the same time, isn't it? You're not, there's the personal, do we have a chemistry, do what we want to do resonate with each other, but also is what we want to achieve similar as well? And that, and we need to do that together, not apart or not at all.
Yeah. Absolutely. I got asked a question, I think it was the first Q&A that we did for Will, which was actually the first time the director, writer-director and I had met in person because we made this film during lockdowns or in between lockdowns. And someone said, like, did you have a lot of arguments or, you know, debates? Okay. And if so, what did you do? And I looked at Dimpner and we both kind of went, we've never had an argument about the film. Never ever, because we both knew from day one what we were aiming for with this film. And as soon as you're both on the same page with that, all of the options become much easier because you're always doing what's best for the film. And as soon as you're both clear on that, it becomes clear what you need to be doing. So you don't end up with arguments of, I want to do this, but I think we should do this and da 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 da. So yes, creative, personal, you want to build that foundation so you can create something really great together in a way that's actually enjoyable and fun.
Now, what about if I'm a nervous writer and I've not had much success with relationships with producers as yet, or I might not have even started one yet. The only people I know are the people I know, and I'm trying to branch out and increase my network. So what should I be doing to start that conversation with a producer I've never met before?
Oh, my favorite question. I would say, first of all, make good use of the internet and social media. Go through and look at what they've posted. Do you actually like some of the stuff that they've posted? You know, people might look at my company's Instagram and be like, wow, I really do not appreciate Charlotte's approach to this stuff. We will not work well together. Great, we've saved so much time in finding that out immediately. Whereas other people might find a producer online and go, wow, I love their approach. Like, I love the way they support, you know, newer filmmakers, for example. And so you start to get a sense of someone and whether you should actually reach out to them or not. And then from there, you can kind of do baby steps. You can leave a couple of comments if you want to. If you want to do sort of dipping your toe in the water first. Leave a couple of comments on recent posts. Send them a quick DM if it's on Instagram. Just let them know how much you're enjoying their content. You can reply to an Instagram story. But any of these really little ways of just sending a quick hello that have no pressure to them. But it's just a nice way for the producer to start seeing your name in a really positive way. They start getting a little bit of recognition. And then you can go straight into sending them an email. You know, you can, or a message. You could go straight in with, hey, I've been seeing your content for the last 2 weeks. I just wanted to say I love what you posted about blah, blah, blah. I would love to buy you a coffee sometime and talk more about insert topic here.
Yeah.
You know, in the same way that you would do with anyone that you want to get to know a little bit better.
Okay. I mean, that's interesting because I read on LinkedIn today about it was connect first and pitch later was the advice. It's just a one line advice.
Yeah, I mean, they've said it better than I ever could. I think that's the thing. People go straight into pitching because they feel like it has to be all or nothing.
Yeah.
Like you have this one shot to send this one project to this one producer. And that just isn't always how it works. You know, sometimes you'll go into a pitch straight away and the producer will go, oh, I'm really sorry. Like I'm completely booked up. Like I have a really full slate at the moment. And all you can really do in that instance is retreat and wait until maybe something else comes up. Whereas if you build a relationship, you don't have that pressure of now or never, you know?
Yeah. I mean, to answer you, now you've said it, it makes me think about this, you know, in my early sort of writing days, there's a lot of writing classes that the advice seems to be, you're going to get stuck in a lift somewhere and you'll need to pitch this thing. So that therefore you bring that lift with you everywhere you go. So it's like whenever you're meeting them, you're in a confined space. And it's now or never. Whereas obviously films take time to get made. Films get time to develop even. So the idea that somebody's going to yay or nay on you because you didn't have the best pitch in the world in the moment you met them, like it was a blink, as opposed to, oh, you've been there. I like going to that place. I've eaten at that restaurant. Those things that make connections real. I like this. You said, don't say in an email what you wouldn't say in person. Do you want to give us some examples that illustrate what you mean by this?
Oh, God, hundreds. I think, again, especially when you get raised with that sort of elevator pitch mentality, you panic, you get a little bit of imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. That's where a lot of that like creative, ongoing, never-ending spiel can sometimes come from. And it also means that you can put everything possible in an email, panicking. And then you just send it to get it out of the way because you know that as soon as you start panicking, you're going to talk yourself out of sending it. So it means that you probably end up sending a lot of emails of, hi, I've got these scripts. I'm looking for a producer. Let me know if you're available for a chat. Now, tell me, because, you know, we've had one other phone call, but I don't get the sense that you would walk up to someone at an event and say, hi, I have two scripts. I need a producer. I'm looking for a production team. Let's go for coffee. And then just walk off. You know, personally, I wouldn't do that. I don't know about you or anyone listening, but I don't feel like that's something you could get away with.
Yeah.
Whereas in an email, people will happily send over whatever it is they want to. And I just think that's not the best way to start a conversation or approach anyone. You know, other people are different. Other people appreciate a very direct approach. But I think that for me and most other producers, filmmaking is about collaboration. You know, we put 3 years worth of work into one short film and it's not for the money. And it often isn't for any kind of career clout. Often when you're trying to make your first feature as a producer, short films don't really count when it comes to credibility and expertise and experience in the way that it does for a writer-director.
Yeah.
A brilliant short film for a writer-director can lead to a huge career opportunity, and it just isn't the same for producers. So we're doing it because we love the story and we believe and want to support the filmmaker behind that story. So start as you would if you were seeing someone in real life at an event with, you know, I don't know, how are you? It'd be a nice start.
Well, I mean, you were talking around it before, but I think a specific thing that you mentioned to me in the past was about not making it seem like work that you're creating for somebody. Like if you make those early interactions where you're trying to, I guess, get noticed, but without being, like you say, I've got three scripts, here's the pitches, what do you want? What do you mean by not trying to give people too much work in terms of those early interactions?
Yeah, it's a really useful rule, because as soon as you frame it in that light, people go, oh, I see what you mean. If I send you a 15-page script, which is probably average for a short film, not even a feature, it's going to take me 15 to 30 minutes to read it. And most people don't actually like reading scripts,
even if
they've asked for them.
No, they don't.
Yeah, everyone has a big mental block around them. So if you send me your script, especially if it's super early in the conversation, and particularly if I have not asked for that script yet, you're effectively asking me to find 30 minutes somewhere in the day to read your script for nothing in return for me. And I don't like to frame this as a, you know, transactional thing of you have to do something for me and then I'll do something for you. I don't mean it like that at all. I just mean if a stranger comes up to you and says, give me 30 minutes of your time, the natural response is, no, thank you very much.
Yeah.
So instead, that's why you do things like a log line and then a treatment and then a pitch deck, because you're giving someone a little bit more each time, but you're not just bombarding them with 30 minutes worth of unpaid work that doesn't give them anything. You know, it's being respectful of their time whilst also making sure that you're telling them what you need to tell them.
So you've talked around the idea of contacting and emailing and all this kind of thing. But the big question for a writer who is having those fear and those imposter syndrome things plaguing their mind, to submit your script or not submit your script, when is too soon?
I think that's the great thing of actually producers and writers just talking or even listening to podcasts. I think it's very easy for producers to become like vaguely mythical creatures. People often say, where are all the producers? And I'm like, it's not like we're all hanging out on an island with everyone else. So it's worth remembering that it's just a regular person having a conversation with, you know, it's a little bit like if you're on a date with someone.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Someone and the other person goes in to kiss you immediately, that's not going to set the right tone. So you can, again, kind of think of it in that sense. Like, you'll have a sense of when the conversation naturally moves onto things like treatments and pitch decks and scripts. The first thing you want to do is establish some form of connection, whether that's through social media, maybe it's a mutual connection, maybe you went to the same film school as the other person, whatever it happens to be, maybe you were both at the same event, anything just to set a bit of a friendly tone to the conversation. Find out if they actually are looking for new projects at the moment. That will save you a lot of frustration later on. You know, they might say, I'm completely swamped at the moment. It's the really busy season. And you can go, oh, that's really great to hear. Tell me about what you're working on. And you get to keep that conversation going and that relationship going, rather than it being a, oh, you didn't want my script, bye, which is what it can sometimes end up being. As soon as they say, what are you working on? And every filmmaker will ask you at some point, what are you working on? Because it's how we ask people, you know, it's the equivalent of how are you if you're in the film industry.
Indeed.
You can say, oh, well, it's really interesting that you mentioned so-and-so, something that you've been talking about, because I've actually been working on this project about whatever it happens to be. Give them the log line, find some way of connecting it into what you've been talking about. Even if it's the most vague, tenuous connection you can possibly come up with, it's a nice way to kind of lead it in or just connect it with something that they're already familiar with. And if they say, oh, that sounds really interesting, tell me more about that, then you start going through that process of log line, short synopsis, maybe current stage. You can say, you know, I've just finished a new draft of it. I'd be happy to send you the treatment or the script if you'd be interested in reading it. But crucially, you want to get to that point where they seem genuinely interested and they want to read the script. Every producer and every filmmaker, just plain filmmaker, has been sent scripts and project materials that they don't really want, that they don't really have the time to go through and read. And it's not that any producer is ever ungrateful to have someone share their work with them. I don't want anyone listening to this thinking that we're all set, you know, somewhere in our island of producers only, you know, bliss, not appreciating when someone takes the time to send us what they've created. But just bear in mind that if you're sending a script out, guaranteed there'll be 10 other people doing the same thing that day or that week. And so you can let the conversation gradually grow to talking about projects that they seem interested in. And guaranteed they'll say, yeah, send me the treatment, send me the pitch deck, send me the script. I think the answer to when is it too soon is when a producer doesn't seem interested, when you haven't gotten to that point of making them interested enough, would be the short answer.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And to be honest with you, I kind of try and I've almost tried to make it like my dogma now, which is I don't want to talk about what I do until I've had a conversation with somebody. So I'd rather be talking about how the festival's been or what your football team is or whatever else it might be. Anything but, it's almost like anything but film, because in a way you're trying desperately to establish whether or not there's any connection, never mind whether or not they're going to want to read your script. Because if you don't, if going back to what you, where you start the conversation in a way, it's like, if there is no connection, if they read the script, what would it matter? Because they'd be reading something that they're not going to connect with either, just because it's still you. And it's honestly, it's always a good measure, I think. If you can have a conversation with somebody and they want to have a conversation with you, that's much better than if they want to hear your pitch to start with, because that makes everybody, both of you, seem like reasonable people, as opposed to, like you said, I think you coined it before where you said this isn't transactional. None of it is, until at the point where somebody's saying there's a contract. then there's a transaction.
At that point, it's transactional.
Yeah, and everybody's got to have the business head on and everyone's got to know what their role is. But when you meet people the first time, you never know where it might lead. And like you said, if they don't appear interested, then, yeah, that's just the end of it. So just talk about the weather and they'll go somewhere else for a drink and you'll go somewhere else. And
yeah, that's the thing. You know, I work with a lot of writers and directors because I'm very lucky and I get to work with lots of great people. But so many of them will talk about producers and I say, cool. So, you know, who do you know? Who do you like to work with? They'll often come to me and say they've been trying to find a producer for this project. Guaranteed, they will have maybe two other producers that they know and they've built a relationship with. And guaranteed, one of those producers will have just quit the industry, because that's happening way more than we've ever seen since COVID, since difficulties in, you know, feature filmmaking, as we talked about earlier. Producers are quitting. And it's not like a nice thing to tell people or point out, but it's a reality for a lot of writers and directors, especially newer writers and directors. You need a producer, especially if you're applying to certain funds, but there are fewer producers than we've had previously. And then you also have that issue of the fact that, so yes, one of them might have quit the industry, the other one might be fully booked, or they might be on maternity leave, or they might be just taking a break from the industry. And so it means that writer director is suddenly like, cool, I had two producers and my project has still gone nowhere and it's been 6 months and help is kind of where it gets to.
Absolutely.
Whereas if you're building those relationships on a fairly regular basis, just in a much more casual, easygoing way, you might get to a point where you have 20 producers that you know. and you can go to pretty much all of them with this project, and one of them will say yes.
Mm.
And if that one happens to back out or get booked on something else or whatever it happens to be, you'll have 19 other producers left. And it means that rather than kind of panicking and knocking on every producer door you can find with this one project, and probably not making a lot of friends with the producers you do find, because you will have gone in all guns blazing saying, "Hi, help, we have this project. Our producer's just dropped out. We're looking for someone, da, 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 da." I've had three of those messages this week already. It's Wednesday. It's 6:21 Wednesday. Like, that's where we've gotten to. Whereas for me, you know, I get those things and I understand the panic, but I'm like, cool, that person has not taken 5 minutes to look at our Instagram, where we post a ton of content each week, or our website to find out who we are or what we've made before.
Mm.
They've just emailed because they've seen it says Charlotte Atkinson, producer.
Got you.
And so it does not create a brilliant relationship from the outset. It means I'm not super interested, frankly, in continuing that relationship. And it means that you kind of get a closed door where you could have had the beginnings of a relationship that might last for the next 20 years.
No, I think what you've talked about in the last 25 minutes or so has been, it's all quite reasonable and rational and practical. So I think, you know, it might not seem fair because, like you say, in your mind, when you've got your inner chimp out and you're panicking about something, then yeah, you are just thinking, I need to solve this problem. But actually, the problem you're trying to solve as a writer, director, or as a writer is create a relationship, stroke partnership with someone that's going to be fulfilling for years to come. And that might mean not working with them for many of those years, but the relationship is what will prosper. And therefore, when the opportunities arise, that's where that partnership will come into its own. You don't buy a ticket, and then if you don't win a prize, that's it. That producer is dead to you forever. It's ongoing. You never know what's around the corner. So thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome. I think that's the thing. Producers, like, we do want to work with you guys. Like, we want writers, we want directors. There's often a bit of a mindset that we don't, or we have enough, or we're already too busy.
Mm.
No, we always want to meet new writers and directors. We always want to hear about what you're working on and what projects you want to get made and how we can maybe work together if it's the right fit to work together. But again, it's very easy to get trapped in whichever pitfall it might be. And it's often just through panic or nerves.
Oh, no,
something as simple as that, you know?
Always, always, yeah. Well, look, thank you for sharing that. It was very generous of you. We're going to move into the... we're going to reveal a little bit about your film watching habits now. We're going to do three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. And I've got a stopwatch here, which will time us for 5 minutes per film, so we don't end up talking about just one film. You've given me three films. I'm going to do them in release date order, if that's okay, the oldest to the newest.
Perfect.
Okay, clock's ticking on Little Women, but not the Greta Gerwig one, which is what I was thinking. And since doing a little bit of research, I've discovered The Little Women is a bit like A Star Is Born. It just keeps getting made and made. So you've chosen 1994's version, directed by Gillian Armstrong. Do you want to tell us when you saw that, how you saw that, and why it had such impact on you?
Yes. I do need to preference it by saying I don't have a hatred of all the other versions, which is sometimes a thing that will happen if you're in the Little Women conversation.
Oh, really?
You can love all of them, yeah. Some people take it as so you don't like the Greta Gerwig version. No, I love the Greta Gerwig version. I've just said the 1994 version because I watched that pretty much constantly when I was growing up.
Okay.
I was very ill as a child. I was off school frequently, and this was well before streaming. So the most I had to watch was mid-morning television. And if you think mid-morning television is dull now, you try watching it when you're 7 years old with tonsillitis. It's not pleasant. And so one of our neighbors from up the road had a VHS tape of the 1994 version of Little Women,
okay,
which had belonged to his late wife. And he'd kept all of her things, with the exception of this VHS tape, which he gave to my mother to give to me because he thought I would enjoy it. And aww, he knew that I was ill so often. And so I thought Charlotte would like this. She can have this. She can keep this. And I have probably watched that film more than any other in my entire life. So that is the reason I love it.
Hmm.
And one of the other things that I also love is that all of the opening credits I say all, I mean about 85% are all women. And so when people say, like, do you ever feel out of place as a female filmmaker? Well, no, because I grew up watching the 1994 version of Little Women, which was directed by Gillian Armstrong, produced by Denise DeNovi, written by Robin Swicord, which I'm hoping I'm pronouncing correctly. And so you just see women after women after women in these credits. And so it becomes ingrained in your mind. Like, of course you can be a female filmmaker. Look at all these other female filmmakers. So that is my monologue that you said was not allowed.
No. I'm happy for you to monologue. I was more saying that you...
Yeah.
So when you first watched this, I mean, because I've not seen this one, but I've seen the Greta Gerwig one. And the Greta Gerwig was obviously the suite of stars of the day. And then I look at the cast of this, and you've got Susan Sarandon, Winona Ryder, Kirsten Dunst, Claire Danes, Gabriel Byrne, Christian Bale, Eric Stoltz. It's like it is the 1990s equivalent, really, in a way.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful film, and it's a beautifully cast film as well, because even though you have all these stars, not once does it feel like one is overpowering the other, which can sometimes happen if you have a bit of an ensemble film with a ton of A-list talent in it. You get all these people who are very used to commanding the screen by themselves. And when you put them all together, it can feel a little bit competitive. Does not happen in the 1994 version. It is beautifully done in every aspect.
I mean, it feels like, in a way, because I thought that's what happened on the recent version, in a sense of there's an unwritten agreement which says we are going to just enjoy playing all the roles. There is no one has to be the star of this movie. Because out of interest then, because I remember, this is now just comparing it to the Greta Gerwig, she talks a lot about how she met the challenges of the backwards and forwards in timeline. Does this play the same game in terms of telling the story?
No, it's purely chronological.
Okay.
I don't think there are any real flashbacks. I'll try and think. I don't think there's any flashbacks at all. It moves continuously forward. And so it does mean that you miss out a little bit of the story from the book. So that's something the Greta Gerwig version has on the Gillian Armstrong version, is that there are a few more sort of subplots that are included. But no, it's this really beautiful progression from childhood to adulthood. It skips forward 4 years at one point of the film, but it means you get to track all of these different characters throughout a fairly expansive chunk of their lives.
And of all the times you've seen it, when you sit down to watch it again, what scene or moment are you waiting to enjoy again that never ceases to have you enthralled?
Ooh, I think any of the big ensemble scenes, so any of the kind of ball scenes. There's this brilliant scene where Meg in the story goes off to a big coming out ball, and it's very ostentatious. And so you see just the expanse of the world that they have created. I think any of the establishing shots of the... Oh, are we done?
We are, yes. Sorry, the alarm went off at my end. I'm very sorry if it did come across at yours.
That's all right. You got my favourite scene.
Indeed. No. I mean, by all means, finish the thought if you've got more to say.
No, I was just going to talk about the kind of set builds, because they built these really beautiful locations that look completely true to life of the time period. So any of the bigger scenes where you just get to see all of what they've created and all of its glory, that's probably my favourite that I look forward to.
Second on your list, we jump into 2013 for John Lee Hancock's Saving Mr. Banks, starring Emma Thompson and Tom Hanks. Do you want to introduce us as to why this had an impact on your life? You know, where and how you saw it?
Yeah. Oh, good question, actually. I'm not sure I remember. The reason it's on my list is it's produced by Alison Owen, who is probably my favorite film producer of all time.
Okay.
And it is one of the most beautiful biopics that does not read as a biopic. It is about the life story of the author of Mary Poppins. And I think a lot of people, especially who grew up with the Julie Andrews, Dick Van Dyke original film version, a lot of us don't know that it's based on books. And so when you get to hear this story of P.L. Travers, you get to hear not only the story of how she created Mary Poppins and this very fractious relationship with Walt Disney, who spent about 20 years trying to get the rights to the book so he can make the film, It's a really brilliantly done portrayal of childhood trauma and difficult life experiences and grief, and how you can get very, very tied up and protective over the creative work that you make that becomes an outlet for all of those things. And so you get to see not only how they created this beloved film that so many people have enjoyed and watched, you know, multiple times, you also get to see the personal impact and sometimes the personal cost of everything that went into it as well.
It's an interesting trend in the sort of in the tens and whatever's of the 21st century, because I saw recently that there's a TV series that's dropped on Paramount, which is called The Offering, which is about how The Godfather got made and what went on in. So it's interesting to look, you know, thinking, talking to a producer and like the idea of what, you know, there's a drama in making something, not just that Mary Poppins was this fantastic successful film. Actually, there was a whole lot more went into what made that success.
Yeah, I loved that show, mostly because people tend to ignore the producer, which obviously I take offense to. I'm kidding. But it's interesting to see how much work goes in before you get to that first day of the shoot. Mm. And I think everyone will, you know, live for production because that's the most exciting bit. But, you know, people will spend 5, 10, 20 years working to get to that point.
Yeah.
And so a film like Saving Mr. Banks is a really beautiful life story. Like, it's not just the story of her agreeing to make the Mary Poppins film. It's her from the age of about 5 years old, you know, in Australia. And so, again, it's a really brilliantly done story that can cover like 60 odd years, realistically, off the top of my head, which is quite a feat for one feature film.
And what you said, Alison Owen's your favourite producer, did you say?
Yes, I did. I don't get starstruck over actors or anyone else, but producers, I behave like an idiot.
So in that sense, then what do you perceive Alison Owen is doing as a producer that makes her impressive to you?
For me, it's the films that she's produced. So Saving Mr. Banks, the 2011 version of Jane Eyre, Elizabeth. All sorts of really beautiful stories that probably wouldn't have gotten made if it was up to any other producer or production company. Mm-hmm. The Harlots on ITV, you know, she's expanding out into TV. And the way that she will go after whichever story or project it is with the level of commitment that, yes, you have to have as a producer, but the level of commitment and kind of care that she'll have to a certain character and showing it in a way that is truthful whilst being entertaining but also non-gratuitous, and this perfect blend that she always seems to achieve, that is probably why on the work side of things she is my favorite producer. I also got to do work experience for her company.
Okay.
So yeah, again, I feel like we have some sort of special connection, although there is very little chance of her actually remembering who the hell I am.
I've had a similar conversation with people who've worked within David Milch, the guy who created Deadwood and the like, was on a podcast, and I was asked. So in that sense, being around someone and seeing them work, was there any particular lesson learned that you could share that you picked up even from the work experience?
Hundreds. The production company actually operates out of her old house up in North London.
Right.
So it feels very cozy and very homely. And she is possibly one of the funniest, like most straightforward people. There are things that I probably cannot say or probably cannot repeat. But I think a highlight is when she was watching rushes for whichever episode of The Harlots it was, and talking about how no one ever went to go and see a film because they heard that the crew had a great time making it. And it's just all these little kind of sound bites of going, oh yeah, of course, like you have to be so pragmatic and not super worried or concerned about sugarcoating things for the sake of somebody else's, you know, feelings or opinions, which you probably find yourself doing too much as a producer. You know, you're working with someone's creative work. A lot of the time you have to be careful around that. But she has this brilliant way of just getting straight to the point and doing what is best for the film without worrying so much.
Brilliant. Well, look, we've we came to an end of the 5 minutes during that conversation. So that was a very nice place to close off on. Now, finally, now we've done, now your first two choices have both been book adaptations and your final choice is an adaptation, but it's not a book adaptation, is it? It is a stage play musical adaptation taken from the stage where it has been beloved for, how long has Cats been a musical?
Over 40 years now. It was 1981, I want to say.
Okay, so a 40-year-old musical that the world, certainly the Western world, knows kind of, you know, really well, gets made into a film, everyone's excited, and this is pre-COVID, so we can't even blame the god-awful virus on what happened to it. And it was directed by the guy that gave us King's Speech and The Danish Girl, so the credentials were all good in Tom Hooper. It starred James Corden, Judi Dench and Idris Elba, to name but a few. But something went wrong, didn't it, with Cats? Do you want to talk us through why this film impacted on you so much?
I'm like three sighs into this already. Yeah, the reason it impacted me is partly because I love the stage version. Both of my parents have worked on the stage version. So I spent a fair bit of time as a kid in rehearsals and, you know, various performances of the show in whichever theatre happened to be closest at the time.
Yeah.
My dad got invited to the gala screening. We couldn't call it the premiere. It was the gala screening because it was quite literally the day before it was released in the UK. That's how tight it was.
Wow.
With deadlines. And he basically phoned me up the day before and said, if I have to sit through this, then so do you. So I said, oh, fine. Had to go all the way to Mayfair for this. And was
out of interest then at that point, was the cat out of the bag anyway, that this wasn't going to be a good experience?
A little bit, because I think it was July that the trailer was released and it looked very weird. And that was a very interesting conversation on social media with a lot of reactions.
Yeah.
With not a lot of positive reactions. And so the film was then released in December. So they had a good few months between the trailer and the film.
Got you. And they were working
to make it better, but expectations were not super high, I would say.
So you and your dad reluctantly went to the gala screening in Mayfair. Go on.
Yes, we did. And we're sat there. My dad has nabbed all of the free chocolate because why wouldn't you? And Tom Hooper gets up on stage to do a little introduction beforehand. And says, with no shame whatsoever, you know, it's just been so difficult since we released the trailer to just get anyone talking about this film. And I genuinely wanted to throw the free chocolates at him because I didn't think sarcasm was going to help in that moment. But the thing is, that show has existed for 40 years in more countries than I can possibly count, because whenever I talk to my dad, he's working on another version of the show somewhere in the world. Yeah, it is pretty much always ongoing. There are hundreds of thousands of people whose livelihoods depend on that show every single year. And Tom Hooper had effectively taken it, done whatever he really wanted to with it, with no, seemingly no respect for what it was and what had come before. And I just watched that film and thought, oh my God, no one is going to watch the stage production now. How much are ticket sales going to go down because of this film that wasn't even finished when they actually released it? They had to go back in and re-edit certain bits because they'd missed it the first time round. And, you know, when you were talking about films that have an impact, this was the first one that came to mind, because I watched that and I saw, you know, Tom Hooper's kind of attitude to the whole thing. And it just made me realize how much care and respect you need to have if you're adapting something.
Yeah.
I don't think you can just take something and do entirely your own version of it if you don't have that level of passion and respect for what already exists. So, yes, I'm still angry about that, if you couldn't tell. But it was a very interesting lesson in seeing what, you know, just for me personally, what I would think is like an acceptable level of care and respect and passion for something.
Yeah.
And I think if you don't have that, if you're not going to improve what already exists, then don't do the film. You know, it's not just on Tom Hooper, I will say. It's a very weird stage show to adapt into a film because there's not really a proper story within it. It's based on a poem. But that for me was like, oh, cool. If you want to do adaptations, this is not the route or the attitude to have when you do them.
Yeah, I mean, I've not seen either the stage or the film version, but I remember watching a Q&A with Dexter Fletcher talking about Sunshine on Leith, which was also a musical that got brought to the screen. But that worked on some level. I mean, obviously, didn't have the cat thing that was a big part of the reaction to the film. But I remember him saying in the Q&A about how what changes got made in the adaptation. So there was big speeches that on stage worked really well. And Peter Mullen, who's in the film version, just went, I can do all that with a look. Don't need to say any of that. You know, it was like, and that became, you know, just how it developed as a production. Until you told me, I had no idea that Cats was based off a poem as a starting point.
It's based on the T.S. Eliot poems. He refused Disney the rights, I believe, because he didn't want them made into cartoon cats, like a very kind of family friendly thing.
Okay.
But yeah, it was eventually turned into a stage production in 1981, I want to say. And yeah, that's it.
And that's our 5 minutes. So thank you for sharing that. It's interesting, you know, so you've got the personal insight with your father as well, obviously him caring deeply about it as someone that's worked on it, and then seeing, I mean, and also to go to a gala screening, which is like going to watch your team at a home stadium. You know, this is where supposedly most people in the room are on your side. I mean, out of interest, was there a stunned silence? Was there chatter? Was there giggling? Was there?
Because
I've been to those screenings of films before where the audience can't contain themselves.
Yeah, it was an interesting mixture of people who'd worked on the film and people who'd worked on the stage production, and you could very clearly tell the difference. And there was a lot of, chatter that goes on afterwards. And the main thing that everyone got told was that Andrew had refused to come to the screening, and it had been a very difficult day in the office.
Oh, dear.
So, yes.
We can all read the subtext there, can't we?
Yes. And then I think he did an interview a few weeks or even months later about how he'd gotten a dog and had been refused. I think he was getting a flight somewhere and they'd said, you can't bring your dog on the plane unless it's a service dog. And he'd said that it was an emotional support dog, something along those lines. And they said, why do you need this? And he said, look at what they did to my show.
Oh, my goodness.
And they let the dog on the plane.
Superb. Well, look, Charlotte. Yeah. Thank you very much for sharing with us, writers, what do producers want, and three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. Before you go, what next for Our Daughter Productions? Anything in the pipeline that you could share?
Ooh, good question. Aside from films, we're working on a lot more digital products and resources.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of my least favorite things about producing is how intense it is time-wise. And so we wanted to be able to create things that can genuinely help people get their films made without needing, you know, full support or one-to-one support if they're struggling with like getting a producer on board. So I would say that's probably the fastest moving thing because it moves a lot quicker than films do. But yes, in a nutshell, it's more films and more resources for people.
Brilliant. Well, look, thank you very much for giving your time on the Britflix podcast.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.